whether it would be better to fight or simply to let them kill him and win the war and not having to incur the sin of having to kill his relatives. Now Arjuna, he's given his last reason why he doesn't want to fight. And after speaking, he becomes even more bewildered. The more Arjuna speaks, the more he becomes confused. Finally, because Arjuna is quite intelligent, he realized that I'm bewildered, I'm sitting down, I'm crying, I'm manifesting all the signs of being in Maya. And the more I speak, the worse it becomes. Therefore, he surrenders to Krishna. So he says, Karpanya dosha bhata svabhava prishtami svandharma samudha cheta yatsche sanisitam ruitane shishaseham sarimam tvam prapanam. Now I'm confused about my duty and I've lost all composure because of miserly weakness. In this condition, I'm asking you to tell me for certain what is best for me. Now, I am your disciple and a soul surrendered to you. Please instruct me. Arjuna has come to good sense. He's realized that he cannot, by himself, free himself from his perplexities. As Prabhupada writes here, all the Vedic, by nature's own way, the complete system of material activities is the source of perplexity for everyone. In every step, there is perplexity. And therefore, it behooves one to approach a bona fide spiritual master who can give one proper guidance for executing the purpose of life. All the Vedic literatures advise us to approach a bona fide spiritual master to get free from the perplexities of life, which happens without our desire. And then it says, the Vedic wisdom therefore advises that in order to solve the perplexities of life and to understand the science of the solution, one must approach a spiritual master who is in the disciple succession. It's interesting to note that Arjuna didn't simply take out his book, out his Bhagavad Gita, and start reading. He had to surrender to Krishna, and then it was up to Krishna whether or not he accepted Arjuna. Of course, he didn't perform a fire sacrifice. It's a quick initiation. But still, he had to surrender, and then Krishna had to agree to instruct him. So the idea that one can accept a spiritual master on the apricot platform, on the unmanifested platform, is not shown, at least in the example of Arjuna. He accepted Krishna, who happened to be present right there, and Krishna agreed to instruct him. So that's the relationship between the disciple and the spiritual master. One has to surrender, and then when one sees a sincere surrender, then it's possible that the spiritual master gives instruction. But in the next verse, after surrendering, it appears that Arjuna, he had his fingers crossed, so to speak. Just like when sometimes people make promises, but behind their back they have their fingers crossed. That means I didn't really mean it. It sounds like I'm serious, but I'm not really serious about it. So in the next verse we'll read, he says, Nahi prapashami mamapanudya, yet strosham uschosham indriyanam, avapimavavasapatnaridam, rajan saranam apichadipatyam. I can find no means to drive away this grief, which is drying up my senses. I will not be able to dispel it, even if I win a prosperous, unrivaled kingdom on the earth, with sovereignty like the demigods in heaven. The acharyas say that Krishna, his response was, my dear Arjuna, he said, how can you surrender to me? I'm your friend. How can you accept me as your spiritual master? And besides that, you don't have to surrender to me. All you do is have to fight. And if you fight and you win the kingdom, then all your problems will be solved. But Arjuna's reply was that even if I fight and even if I win the kingdom, even if I get unlimited opulence, still I won't be happy. Therefore, he says, I can't, even if I get this kingdom, still I won't be satisfied. But then he said, now we read the ninth verse, Sanjaya uvacha evam yukva rishikesham gudakesha parantapa yotsiti govinda yukva tushnim vavuvaha. Sanjaya said, having thus spoken, Arjuna chastised with the enemies, told Krishna, Govinda, I shall not fight, and fell silent. So although he surrendered to Krishna, he was still in Maya. Krishna tested him in the last verse, and Arjuna passed the test, saying that I have to accept you, that there's no other way I'm going to get out of Maya, because I'm in Maya. And now we'll see whether Krishna accepts him or not. Because text 10, Tamavacha Rishikesha Prahasa Niva Bharata Sena Yaravayara Madhye Vishidantami Damvacham. O descendant of Bharata, at that time, Krishna, smiling in the midst of both the armies, spoke the following words to the grief-stricken Arjuna. So the word used here is prahasa. Just like in the nectar of devotion, there are many words for smiling. So prahasan means just like smiling. It means that Krishna began, when he recited this verse, he was smiling because he was in the mood of friendship, sakya rasa, with Arjuna. But gradually the smile changed and he became more grave as he was speaking the verse. Because he was entering into the mood of vatsalya rasa, parental rasa. The relation between the disciple and the spiritual master is just like the parent and the child. Because sometimes the children in our culture especially become a little familiar with their parents. They don't take them very seriously. But at least in the Vedic culture, the parents were taken quite seriously. And they had a very respectful relationship, although affectionate. So now Krishna's rasa with Arjuna is changing as he's becoming his spiritual master. So what does he tell Arjuna? My dear Arjuna, please sit down in the chariot. It seems like you're in anxiety. You know, it seems like you have some psychological complex. I'll take out my pad and I'll try and figure it out. Tell me about your early childhood. What was your mother like? Did she ever beat you? Your father, what did he leave? Or what was your relationship? So what was the preaching that Krishna gave Arjuna? He immediately says, my dear Arjuna, you're a fool. That was his subtle comment he makes in the next verse. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha, Aso Chana Vaso Chastvam, Pragyan Vadam Strapachase, Gatasum Zakatasum Chan, Anu Shojiti Pandita. The Supreme Personality of God had said, while speaking learned words, you are mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise lament neither for the living nor for the dead. From the very beginning of Krishna's instructions, he's saying that a learned person is one who's ecstatic. If one is factually learned, it means he's always happy in all circumstances. And if one is lamenting over things that are unworthy to be lamented over, then he must be a fool. It doesn't matter how many verses he knows. He's still in the same position of being a fool. And now Krishna will explain why Arjuna is a fool. So he begins with one verse which defeats Mayavadi philosophy. Text number 12. Natveva hamdatu nasam, natveme nairinadipa, natchaiva nabravi shama, sarveva yamatakparam. Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, or in the future, shall any of us cease to be. This is the introduction to Krishna's instructions. Now here he's saying that I'm a person, that you're a person, and that all these kings are all persons. That not only were persons now, but in the past we were persons, in the present we were persons, and in the future we'll also be persons. So that's one argument defeating Mayavadi philosophy. The other thing is that Krishna, he is his body. If we say, as the impersonalists say, that now we're persons, but after we leave this body, we get back to our original position of impersonality. We become God. We enter into the Brahma Jyoti, and we become the Brahma Jyoti. So if this argument is used, but Krishna is his body, therefore when he says, I was a person in the past, now this is a perfect atmosphere for this is like the 4 months of the rainy season. Chaturmasya. Krishna has arranged the atmosphere for the VIHE here. Krishna was a person in the past, Krishna is a person in the present, and Krishna will be a person in the future. Therefore, there's no question that in the past Krishna doesn't say, I was an in-person, now I've become a person, and in the future I'll become an in-person again. So if Krishna is his body, and he's God, then personality is eternal. And similarly, Arjuna, although him and the kings, Krishna says, you're a person, the kings are persons, in the past you were persons, in the present you're persons, and in the future you'll also be a person. But if the Mayavadis say that Krishna is an illusion when he's speaking this verse, then what's the sense of their using the Bhagavad Gita in the first place? If they're going to, they accept the Bhagavad Gita as an authority, because Mayavadi philosophy, no, sorry, Mayavadi philosophy is based on the Shabda Praman, or authority, just an interpretation of it, and they accept the Bhagavad Gita as an authority, so therefore they cannot deny that Krishna is an authority, otherwise it's useless using the Bhagavad Gita. And if Krishna is an authority, he defeats Mayavadi philosophy here. Any objections? Any questions about this? Yes.
About the
picture. Yeah, sure.
About this relationship of Saturn, spirit master, and Saturn, but also the reproduction of the spirit master.
That's included within it. In other words, from the point of view of the disciple, he's in the mood of a servant. Hopefully he grows up after some time. Many disciples are in the mood of children. But actually they're supposed to grow up. But the mood of Vatsalya Rasa, even a child, his mood is basically that of service. When he grows up, when he gets older. Isn't that right? Yes. You mean the 100,000 lakhs of verses from the Vedas?
Yeah.
Well, previously people used to be the Brahmin priests. They used to spend practically their whole life studying the Vedas.
At what time was it that they were still reading?
In Dwarpa Yuga, especially in Treta Yuga, when sacrifices were being performed. Then at that time people lived for many more years than they had the time. And to be trained as a Brahmin priest, then they have to read the whole Vedas. They have to go through the whole thing. At least in Kali Yuga, at the beginning, they divided the Vedas up into four different sections so that the Brahmin priests didn't have to study all four Vedas. They'd come together, and each one of them, they'd execute a certain part of the ritual. But nowadays, there's no possibility of performing these sacrifices. And the Vedas, because the Vedas are really meant to bring one to the platform of understanding Krishna. So the Vedas themselves are meant to establish faith in the process of the scripture, accepting the scriptures. And the persons who are authorized to preach or to perform the rituals within the scriptures. So the Vedas were a certain section, and that's meant for people in general, because that's what most people are interested in. As Prabhupada said, if you're going to sell a diamond, you'll get only a few customers. But if you're going to sell, you know, some plastic jewelry, then you'll have people line up in the Kmart or whatever they have. They're flooded with people. But in a very expensive jewelry store, hardly anyone goes there. Isn't that right? They were. At least they could read the Vedas. At least the Brahmins could do it. People in general didn't read the Vedas. Because they wouldn't let people read the Vedas, because if you perform the sacrifice incorrectly, then you get the opposite reaction. If you chanted the mantra incorrectly, just like when Twasa chanted the mantra to get an enemy of Indra, because he made one mistake, at least the Brahmin priests did. They chanted one word long instead of short, and therefore instead of getting a demon who is an enemy of Indra, they got a demon whose enemy was Indra. They got the exact opposite. Or when Sudakshina performed the sacrifice, created a demon to destroy Dwarka, but because he couldn't destroy Dwarka, instead he came back and burnt to ashes Sudakshina and all the priests. So it's dangerous to chant the Vedas, unless you chant them properly. So only the Brahmins would chant the Vedas. But people in general, they had material desires, just like they do now. And they go to the priest, and the priest would chant the mantras, perform the ritual, and their desires would be fulfilled, the people who asked them to perform the sacrifice. And this way, people develop faith in the Vedas, although they themselves didn't execute the rituals within them. They develop faith in the priests and the scriptures that dealt with the Vedas. Is that clear? Why is it? It was given. But just like we can see, that in Kali Yuga, although this process is given, most people still, they read Time Magazine and the newspapers. And they have faith in the scientists that, you know, the new inventions that the scientists come out will make them happy. So still they have faith in materialism. Instead of chanting the Vedas, they chant Time Magazine. So people say, of course, Time Magazine is not the Vedas. But they still have faith in materialism. And a few people are interested in bhakti. Therefore, a few people study Krishna book. Even in the, if you do a survey of devotees' reading habits, I don't think the ISKCON devotees are quite up to being full scholars yet. In terms of deeply studying the scriptures that we even have. Most people are not interested. But in the Veda culture, what they did have the opportunity to experience was that they put on plays all the time. The whole art, the whole culture was immersed in Krishna Katha. So although they didn't study the Vedas, still they, at night, they, just like in India now, you can go there, and they'd have Kathakali. Is that right? Kathakali? Kathakali. So the whole night, people after working in the field all day long or in their office, whatever, they, at 9 o'clock at night, they assemble. And they watch a play for 6 hours until Mangal Arati started. So they'd see plays of the Ramayana, or everything was based on the pastimes of Lord Ramachandra, Mahabharata, or different pastimes of incarnations. So in this way, people were absorbed in the culture of Krishna Katha, although they personally wouldn't study even probably the Mahabharata sometimes. But they'd see it in drama and art and plays and music. That way they were absorbed in Krishna consciousness. Yes?
I want to thank you very much for making it clear that in Bhakti Yoga, elements of Jnana Karma and Ashtanga Yoga are taken, that Bhakti Yoga can be called Bodhi Yoga or Nishkama Karma Yoga. Now, I do have one last term which I need to put somewhere. It's Sakama
Karma Yoga.
Yoga. Where does this fit in this expression?
So, that's Karma Yoga.
This is
Yoga. Yeah, that was when I put two arrows, those were both Sakam Karma Yoga. Mm-hmm. Or actually, when I put Karma Yoga, the first one, that's Sakam Karma Yoga. One has material desires, but he knows that the goal is Vishnu. So the Karma Kanda, immediate results, or long-term results, that's karmakanda. But when one knows that the goal is Vishnu, but he's still addicted to the results of his work, to get the results back, then that's all called sakam karma yoga. Karma yoga but with material desire. And when karma yoga is devoid of material desire, he knows that the goal is Vishnu, then it's just called, then karma yoga means the same thing as buddhi yoga or Krishna consciousness. But sometimes Prabhupada translates Krishna consciousness as Buddha Yoga, sometimes he says it's Karma Yoga, and sometimes he says it's Bhakti Yoga. But generally Bhakti Yoga is Bhakti Yoga, but Karma Yoga can be Sakam Karma Yoga. Mm-hmm. The Prabhupada never, he doesn't generally do that. He just takes the highest standard and he just explains the highest standard throughout. Because otherwise we think, yeah, this is great. This Krishna is authorizing. I'm following the Bhagavad Gita and I'm performing my devotional service and I have a big, in my locker, I have a big heart with, and there it says, Uma. So my real goal is to go to Apsara Loka and meet some of the ladies there. And it's right there in the Bhagavad Gita, I'm following Krishna's instruction, that you just perform your sacrifice, and if you don't become a devotee in this lifetime and go back to the spiritual world, you get the opportunity to go to the heavenly planets. And there you can enjoy in the Nandakandana forest with the Apsaras for 100 billion years. And afterwards you can come back and try and become a devotee again. So I'm following Krishna's instructions. This is great. But that's not what Krishna wants. He doesn't want us to work thinking in the back of my mind, I'm performing devotional service, I'm not going to become that serious at the end of my lifetime. I can see my mind is not fixed on Krishna. So, it's assured my next lifetime, I'll go to the heavenly planets, I'll go with Indra. Everything's pretty cool. And it's all following the instructions of Bhagavad Gita. But Krishna doesn't want that, and we shouldn't want that either. Because if we go to the heavenly planets, and we're there, even for a few days, or for a couple of months, then we come back here, and we come back here after the 10,000 years of the golden age finished, then we maybe even come back as devotees, but we find out that there's little people 2 feet high running after us with a... It may not be very pleasant. So we shouldn't want to go to the heavenly planets. We shouldn't want to do that. We should try to make our lives successful and become fixed in Krishna consciousness in this lifetime. It's a very risky business. Is that right? Yes. Fewer their years. What? Fewer their years? How is it possible? Well, generally you live there for a longer time. But sometimes the demigods, they fight against the demons and they're killed because they didn't really perform so many pious activities. Therefore, their stay in the heavenly planets is not very long. It's not that everyone lives there for the same duration of life. Yeah, you may not come back in Kali Yuga. You may wind up in Satya Yuga or in the next Kali Yuga. It depends. It's a gamble. But it's unlikely you'll come back in the next Yuga of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu when he appears. Because he only appears once in the day of Brahma. And a day of Brahma is 4,300,000 years times 1,000. That's his one day and then the equal night. So that's 4,300,000,000,000 years. So it's unlikely that you'll just hit the right spot. It's a gamble, but if you want to take the gamble, then it's like if you had a whole stack, you know, you had 4 billion cards, you know, what's the likelihood that you'll get the one card that you're looking for in it? It's not very common. It's a chance. You might get it. You might not. So we, as Pariksha Maharaj, even he prayed that if I have to come back, at least let me come back in the association of devotees. That my dear Brahmins, when he was going to leave his body, he prayed, my dear Brahmins, if I have to leave my body, that's all right, but please go on singing the glories of the Lord, and if I have to take birth again, at least let me take birth in the association of devotees. We'll stop there. Thank you very much. Grantharaj Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Gaur Premanande. Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Yesterday we were reading from the beginning of the section on jnana. So jnana means what? Knowledge. Knowledge about what? About what? Yes, the self. And who's the self? And who else is the self? And who else? Krishna. Vedanti tat tat vidas tat vyaj jnanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavan iti shabdite. So when you say Brahman, we can also include nature, the material nature, which is a manifestation of Brahman. But transformation. In any case, knowledge means to know about matter and spirit, the difference between matter and spirit, and the controller of both. So Krishna, he told Arjuna that because he had Shastric knowledge, that wasn't enough. He wasn't considered learned because he didn't know the difference between his body and himself. Therefore, he said he was an apandita. He was chastising him. So here, we went over that we are our spiritual body, but we're not our material body. And now Krishna is going to explain a very famous verse. You can read text 13. Tenosminita dehe komaram yovanam jara tatadahantara prapir diryas tatra namuyati. As the embodied soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change. The aim of human life is to become dira, or sober-minded, so that at the time of leaving this body, we're not bewildered. Because the time of leaving this body is so painful that it is very difficult to be sober. One time when Prabhupada stepped on a thumbtack, and the devotee who witnessed it, he just lifted his foot up and he just very casually took out the thumbtack. So this is an example of tolerance. Now most of us, if we step on a thumbtack, we might get a slightly different reaction. You know what a thumbtack is? It's a this metal, a little round metal with a thing sticking up that you put into a board to stick something onto a board. You know what a thumbtack is? What's that? So most of us would have a slightly different reaction. You know, the ambulance would be called and two surgeons would come by. So what to speak of the time of death, which is unlimitedly painful, as compared to a thousand scorpion bites simultaneously. Has anyone ever had a scorpion bite? You've heard of people who had scorpion bites? It stings. Maybe 100,000 bee stings. In any case, one has to learn how to become dira, but the best way of becoming dira is to come to the transcendental platform. If one is on the transcendental platform or Krishna conscious, then he doesn't have material experience the same way that an ordinary person does. We have the ability either to transfer our consciousness to Krishna, and that's called Krishna consciousness, or we can remain identified with this body and this mind, and that's called material consciousness. Our free will, as explains in the Bhagavatam, is a exercise whether or not we want to identify ourselves with this body and with our temporary circumstances, or we identify ourselves with Krishna and with our eternal position. One who puts into practice his identity as a soul, that's called devotional service. And one who remains in the material platform, then he continues on in the cycle of birth and death. Whether we're dear or not depends upon how much we practice during this lifetime to come to the transcendental platform. That is to think that one has no goal in life save and except to act in Krishna consciousness just to satisfy Krishna. And while acting in such a way, one should think of Krishna only, that I've been appointed to discharge this particular duty by Krishna. In other words, if we are convinced that whatever I'm doing that because Krishna wants me to do it. And the reason why I'm doing it is to please Krishna. Then, one probably said, one will naturally think of Krishna. Any other way of trying to think of Krishna will be somewhat artificial. And because it's artificial, we won't be able to think of Krishna for a very long time. Probably said, for instance, people can chant Hare Krishna and they get benefit. But as far as being able to steadily chant Hare Krishna, that's only possible if we develop an attitude of trying to please Krishna. That's called a service attitude. And if what we're doing is authorized by Krishna through the disciple succession, then if we do those two things, then Krishna naturally reveals himself. It becomes very easy to think of Krishna. So here, Krishna is giving the argument that Bhishma and Drona, they're going to change their bodies. That it doesn't really matter that whether or not you fight or not, still their bodies change. This is just a natural thing. So why should you lament over a change of body? Just like, for instance, there was one king, his name was Yayati. Yayati was a young man. He was wandering in the forest one day as a king, and he came upon a well, and in the well was one lady, her name was Damayanti. Was Damayanti the one in the well, or Sarmishta? Sarmishta was in the well. So Sarmishta was the daughter of Sukracharya. And Yayati, he helped her out of the well, and they later on were married. What's that? Devayani was the one who was the daughter of... So Devayani, they were married, and later on by some arrangement, he also fathered a child with Sarmishta. So Devayani became very disturbed, went to her father, Sukracharya, who was a powerful Brahmin, and he cursed King Yayati to become impotent, to become old. So suddenly he was an old man, and then Sukracharya realized that the person who's going to suffer the most is my daughter, so I've just cursed him, but my daughter's going to suffer, so we have to make some other arrangement. So he gave him the option that you can transfer your old age to one of your sons. So he went to all his sons, Yadu and others, and they said, well, we'd love to do it, but it's just not possible right now. But finally he went to Puru, his son, and he transferred his old age to Puru. And this way he got a new young body. So would anyone lament? Poor King Ayati, he transferred his body. He got an old one, now he got a youthful one. So would anyone think that he was unfortunate because he got a new body? So in the same way, the body is always changing. And here Krishna is using the example that it goes from boyhood to youth. And later on, Krishna gives the example that Ishvara Sarabhutanam Ride Se Arjuna Tishtati Brahmayan Sarabhutani Yantra Rudani Maya. So Krishna compares the body to a yantra, which means a machine. So do machines grow? Has anyone ever seen a machine grow? No, machines don't grow. If you want a big clock from a little clock, you have to make a whole different clock. There's nothing you can do to the little clock to make it into a big clock. So similarly, it is not that our body is growing, according to Krishna's analogy. What it is, it's changing. One moment we have one body, the material nature gives us one body, and the next moment gives us another body. Therefore, change of body is already going on from boyhood to youth and then to old age. So after getting old age, we have to have another change of body. So just as we've changed our body already, so we'll get another change of body, and that's called a new body. But will anyone lament because now I've lost my old body, and now I've got a young body? Generally, when one is young, he thinks, if only I could be older. And when one is older, he thinks, if only I could be younger. No one will lament these changes of body. So Krishna says, why are you lamenting that grandfather Bhishma, he has an old body. He's going to lose his body, but he'll get a nice new body. he'll get a 19, well, whatever the year was, I don't know what they were saying, but here we'd say he'd get a 1996 model. So Arjuna next, he says, but my dear Krishna, that's all right. You're saying that Grandfather Bhishma, he's going to get a nice new body. Dronacharya will get a nice body. All my relatives, everyone's going to get a nice new body. But I am connected with them and their body. So I'm going to feel bad because I'm going to feel separation from them. They're going to leave and I'm going to be left here and I won't be able to associate with them and I'm going to miss them. So Krishna says in the next verse, text 14, it's not that Krishna, Arjuna says, yeah, that's a great thing. It'd be so fantastic to kill them. I'll be doing them a favor. Let's see, maybe afterwards I can go out and kill a few more people. Give them nice new bodies. No, Arjuna wasn't thinking like that. That it'll be so nice to kill people and help them out that way. Text 14. Matra sparshastu kunteya shitoshna sukadukada agama paino nityastam titiksha svabharata. O son of Kunti, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and the disappearance in due cause are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perceptional sign of bharat and one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. So here are what's used is tolerance. So Krishna says, yes, if you kill your relatives, you're going to feel pain and you'll feel separation, but you have to tolerate because that's the nature of the material world. There's nothing you can do to save them anyhow. It's not that if Arjuna doesn't fight, that Bhishma and Drona, they won't get another body. At every moment they're getting a body. But you should do your duty, whatever you're supposed to do, and whatever happens, you should learn tolerance. And what is the reason to learn tolerance? Krishna has already said that Adhira, he's not bewildered by the changes. But one who's not tolerant, he's always bewildered. So, text 15. Yam hinavyan jyantyate purusham purusharshava samaduka sukham dhiram samritat vayakalpate. O best among men, Arjuna, the person who is not disturbed by happiness and distress and is steady and bold is certainly eligible for liberation. From the Krishna consciousness point of view, if we do our duty in Krishna consciousness, then the result is that knowing well how Krishna is the controller of everything, knowing how Krishna is the, everything should be done for his pleasure, and that he's a real friend of everyone, we can do our duty without being disturbed. But for one who's not in Krishna consciousness, it takes a great mental effort to do it. To do one's duty, that's called karma kanda, for instance. One has to do his duty, but he's expecting some reward in the future, so he tolerates whatever problems comes upon him. And for the jnani, he knows he's not his body, therefore he suffers so many inconveniences, or the yogi, but he's expecting something in the future, like liberation or whatever. So his goal is fixed on liberation, so he's trying to get that goal. But sometimes, if he can't tolerate, he falls down, and then he has to start all over again. That famous story of Vishvamrita Muni, after he was fighting with Vashistha Muni, he then decided that the only way he could conquer a Brahmin would be by becoming a Brahmin himself. Just to make the story short, but one time Vishvamrita Muni, he was wandering with his army. He had hundreds and thousands of soldiers. And he came upon this little hermitage and he decided, let me go down and see the Brahmins, give them some respect. He went down to the little hermitage and he offered his respect to the Brahmin there who happened to be Vashistha Muni. So Vashistha Muni said, my dear Brahmin, my dear king, I have to give you some hospitality, so let me offer you some food and a little prasadam for your army. So Vishvamrita Muni said, no, it's all right. You know, I have hundreds and thousands of warriors and elephants and horses and so many different things. So it's not possible for you in this little hermitage to feed us. He said, no problem, just bring them all down here. I'll have, you know, give you a little prasadam. So he said, all right. So he started to bring his army down. When he came down, suddenly everything, his whole army fit into the little place there. It was like that little place was like a huge field. And then he said, just sit all your army down. So the hundreds and thousands of warriors, they just sat down in lines. And then Vashishtha Muni said, think of whatever plate you like and it'll immediately manifest. So they all thought of a plate. Some people thought of a golden plate or a silver plate or a diamond plate. And all these plates manifested. Then he said, think of whatever preparations you want and they'll all manifest. So all the soldiers and the elephants and the horses, they all thought of their favorite oats and bananas and globjamins, and they all manifested themselves on the plate, unlimitedly. And they all had a huge feast. And then he said, for entertainment, whatever you want will come. So then they thought, Vishramrita, who was the king at that time, he said, I want to see the dancing girls in Swetadweep, where Lord Vishnu is lying on the ocean of milk. So immediately the dancing girls from the ocean of milk came, and they performed their transcendental dance. And this way, King Vishramrita was completely amazed. And he said, where is this all coming from? So he said, it all comes from my cow here, Subali, that from her everything comes. So he said, I would like one thing from you. So he said, yeah, I'll give you one thing, as long as it's not my cow. He said, no, that's what I want, your cow. I'll give you 100,000 cows in exchange for your one cow. And he said, no way. So then he decided, the king said, well, if you won't exchange the cow, then I'll take the cow. So he started to drag the cow away. And then the cow, it was a Sarabi cow, broke away, came running back to Vishishtha Muni and said, why didn't you defend me? He said, well, I'm just a Brahmin. What can I do? But the cow said, you have to defend me. So he said, yes, from your udder, manifest so many rakshasas, so many yaksha warriors. And so from his udder came so many different types of warriors, and they all rushed upon Vishramrita's army and devoured it. Just like fire devours straw. And they all burnt up. They were all killed. And the only person left was Vishramrita. So he thought the Brahmin's power is infinitely greater than that of a Kshatriya. But he decided to become a Brahmin. To become a Brahmin is not so easy, a real Brahmin. So he decided he'd go and perform some meditation for a few years. So he sat in meditation for 60,000 years. And as we know, Indra thought that here's a person. He wants my post, my position. And he knows what to do because he has a lot of experience. So he sent one Apsara, and she, just by hearing the ankle bells, we can imagine Vishramrita was just waiting for someone to come along. He's probably a little bored to 60,000 years of meditating. And he heard the ankle bells, he opened his eyes, and that was it. And his 60,000 years went out the window. Then after some time, he had one daughter, her name was Shakuntala, who was a very famous young lady. And so he decided, I've just wasted my time, 60,000 years, but this time I'm going to do it right. So this time when Vishramrita heard the ankle bells, he became so infuriated that he opened his eyes, and from his eyes fire came and she was burnt to ashes. So this time he fell down due to anger. So another 60,000 years out the window. It's not easy to be tolerant, even if you practice for a long time. So then he had to go for another 60,000 years, and finally Brahma came and made him a Brahmin. So if you get a sacred thread, you can understand. It's not an easy thing to become a Brahmin. It takes some tolerance. But one who's able to tolerate, he's eligible for liberation. In other words, most of what we have to learn, even as devotees, is tolerance. Sometimes it seems that everything's going all my way, that Krishna, he's finally realized what a nice person I am, and he's making everything easy for me, and everything's going nicely. And the next day, everyone's kind of looks at us with a kind of mean look on their face, and nothing seems to go our way, and we think, Krishna's probably forgot who I am. He's got the real wrong person. He's not organizing things properly. But we have to learn tolerance, because at the time of death, it's not that everything will go our way. And the main lesson we have to learn is how to tolerate and at the same time fix our consciousness upon Krishna. So Bhagavad Gita deals a lot with that, but it is, as it says throughout the whole Bhagavad Gita, that if one can fix his mind on Krishna and devotional service, then it's easy to tolerate. One devotee at the airport, once, when he went out one time, he walked up to one person, and the first thing the person did was he took his fist and smashed it into the devotee's face. And the devotee just fell on the ground, got up, and went to the next person to distribute another book. So, but if one is fixed in the mission of Krishna consciousness, then it's much easier to tolerate. We may not be so tolerant, but we can appreciate these stories. Now Krishna, he says, 16, Nasato vidite bhavo nabhavo vidite sita upayau vidrishtantas twanayos tatradarshivi. Those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, the material body, there is no endurance, and of the eternal, the soul, there is no change. This they have concluded by studying the nature of both. In other words, anything that changes isn't really existing. For instance, it appears that this body that we have exists. But, as I pointed out, the body is always, at every moment, it's changing. The only difference is it appears to us to be the same body, although it's always a different body. In that respect, the body doesn't exist. For instance, generally people don't take seriously what they've experienced in a dream. For instance, if someone in your dream gives you $1 million for the temporary dream, you may feel some satisfaction. But when you wake up from the dream, you generally don't feel disappointed that I was rich last night, I had so much money, and now I lost it all because I woke up. Everything was all right in my dream, but this world is not so nice. Similarly, if one wakes up to the fact that this material existence, our daydream, is nothing more than a dream, then he's not disappointed in the midst of so-called gain and loss. Gain and loss, generally because of the duality of the material world, happiness and distress, heat and cold, we're always in anxiety about what we're gaining and what we have possibly to lose. But one who's awake, he realizes that I'm not this body, therefore I have nothing to gain here and nothing to lose. Krishna says, such a person, he has knowledge. And anyone who's attached to the temporary, he has no knowledge. That one who's aware of the eternal, that he's called a seer of the truth. And one who's not, he's in ignorance. Again, Krishna is criticizing Arjuna, saying that you're attached to the temporary, everything, but you're not aware of the eternal, therefore you're not a learned person. Now Krishna will say, text 17, Avinashi tu tadvidi yena sarvam idam tatam vinasham avyasyasya nakaschit kartumarasi arti. That which pervades the entire body you should know to be indestructible. No one is able to destroy the imperishable soul. Here's Krishna's example that what's eternal in the body is the soul. And what's the symptom of the soul?
Consciousness.
Right. That if you take a dead body, you stick a pin in it, the dead body won't protest. But if you take someone here and you start sticking pins in them, some will protest. Because consciousness is there. So consciousness is a symptom of life. Material energy, just like the wall or the floor, is made out of the same energy as our body is, but because there's no consciousness, therefore there is no life within it. So consciousness is a symptom of the soul. Just like Krishna will say, Yata prakashayat yekam kritsnam lokam imam ravi shetram shetri tata kritsnam prakashayati bharata. Just like the sun is situated in one place, but it illuminates the whole universe with sunlight, so the soul, situated in one place in the body, is illuminating the body with consciousness. we ourselves were in one place in the body, and we're illuminating the body with consciousness. Therefore, we're aware of everything except for ourselves. And Krishna consciousness means that by becoming aware of Krishna, simultaneously we also become aware of ourselves. So the first thing, that which is eternal, Krishna explains here, is the self, who has consciousness, and therefore he's conscious. But, and therefore, you can't kill the soul. And text 18, Antavanti me deha nityasyokta sharirina anashinam pramedyasya tasmadyujasva bharata. The material body of the indestructible, immeasurable, and eternal living entity is sure to come to an end. Therefore, fight, O descendant of Bharata. So the soul is eternal. You can't kill the soul, but the body, it has to die, or at least change. Death is simply the final change of the body. But the body has to vanish or be vanquished sometime or another. Therefore, your argument that you don't want to kill your relatives is not valid because you can't kill your relatives because they're not their body. But their body, which you think is them, that's going to be die in the course of time anyhow. You can't prevent their death. Therefore, Krishna says in text 19, Yainam veti hantaram yas chayinam manyitam hatam ubhavato na vijanitam nanyam hanti na hanyate. He who thinks that the living entity is a slayer, or who thinks that he is slain, is neither he who thinks that the living entity is a slayer, nor he who thinks that it is slain, is a knowledge, for the self slays not, nor is slain. In other words, the soul, as Krishna will explain later on, also in different ways, is not the doer of the activities. Therefore, the soul can't be killed because he's not the body. And the person who thinks that he's killing the soul, he's also not a knowledge, because the soul can't do anything. It is the material energy under Krishna's guidance that kills. In other words, I may move my hand, but I'm not actually moving. I'm not moving, nor am I moving my hand. What I'm doing is desiring. And because I desire that my hand be moved, therefore Krishna is within my heart as a super soul. He senses that desire just like one can smell the flavor of flower by being near it. And understanding what the flavor of the flower is, or what the desire is, Krishna orders the material energy to arrange herself in such a way as to fulfill that desire according to what I deserve. Although it may appear that someone is the killer, what's actually happening is that the soul is desiring, and Krishna, is through the material energy, is making that arrangement. That it appears that someone's dying. But neither the person in the body who has to leave the body dies, nor the person who's seemingly killing is actually doing the killing. It is all based on desire. And text 20 is a summary. We can read that. Yes. Yeah, sure. Adishtanam tata karatam karyam chala vidam. So Krishna says, Adishtanam tata karata. Adishtanam means the place, and the karta means the doer. Karanam means the instruments, in Bodhame. Then he says, the false ego and the super soul. These are the five factors. So the body is the place of activity. So we have this body, this material body. We ourselves are the soul. The instruments that we're doing our activities with, those are the senses. And the false ego, that's the, what's that? Consider the endeavor that causes the endeavor. Connection of the souls with the material body through the false ego causes the endeavor. And then finally, there's the super soul. Well, I don't know if he says material in that sense. I don't think he says material. You can see only the four material causes, but the supreme efficient cause as well. He doesn't mean material Material means the ingredient causes. In other words, is just like if you want to build a building, you have to get the material causes for the building are like the bricks and the mortar and the different things that go into making the building. And the efficient cause is that which brings them all together and makes it all happen. Like the builder, for instance, would be the efficient cause. Because you may have all the ingredients, but without the efficient cause, nothing happens. So when he says material cause, he doesn't mean the soul is one of the made out of matter. He just means that it's one of the things that the super soul deals with to make everything happen. Is that clear? Text 20. Nijayate mriyate va kadachin nanyam bhutva bhavita vanabhuyaha ajo nitya shasvato yam parano nahanyate hanyamane sharire. For the soul, there's neither birth nor death at any time. He has not come into being, does not come into being, and will not come into being. He is unborn, eternal, ever-existing and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. So these are very important qualities of the soul. Prabhupada many times would point these out. For instance, that he's ever-existing and unborn, eternal, ever-existing, primeval. He's not slain when the body is slain. This is more or less a summary. The soul existed in the past, he exists in the present, and it will also exist in the future. Now, after hearing this, Krishna explains from a different point of view. Text 21. Vedavinashinam nityam yainam ajam avyam katam sapurusha partha gamgyatiti hantikam. O Partha, how can a person who knows that the soul is indestructible, eternal, unborn, and immutable, kill anyone or cause anyone to kill? In other words, one who's in knowledge, he knows that he can't really kill anyone, nor can he cause anyone to kill. But as Prabhupada explains in the purport, that everything has its proper utility. When the king or the judge condemn someone to death, it's actually for that person's benefit. Similarly, when a surgeon orders an operation, although it may be violent, still the patient benefits. Similarly, when the supreme person orders Arjuna to kill someone, it's to be understood as to the person's benefit. That's called justice. Yes?
So if I would come up and kill someone, then I would use it against them?
Yeah, from Maya, for the false ego. In other words, it's not sufficient just because the desire is there. In one sense, you may be an instrument, but not for Krishna. You may be rewarding maybe the instrument to award some of their previous activities. But if it's not sanctioned by Krishna, then you also have to take part in the reaction. Yeah, previously, as we know, that if people desire it, they get the credit, either pious or impious, for their desire. And that in previous yugas, if someone desired, for instance, to steal, he'd have to suffer the reaction for stealing. Fortunately, in this age, we don't get reactions for our impious desires, but we get credit for our pious desires. If anyone has any pious desires outside of the Krishna consciousness movement, they get some credit for it. Well, we don't have independent desires. We're not desiring in a vacuum. We're placed in this body, and we're placed in some circumstances. And according to those circumstances, we're desiring. Now, either we can dovetail our desires with Krishna's desires, because Krishna also has an interest in what's going on here. Or we can dovetail our desires with our own limited interest, body or extended body, selfish desires. So we have no independent desires here, but we can dovetail our desires either with our material conception of life or with our spiritual conception. So text 22, Vasam sujirani yata vihaya navani grinati niro prani tatashirani vihaya jarnyani nani samyati navani dehi. As the person puts on a new garments, giving up the old ones, the soul similarly accepts new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. Here Krishna is more or less joking with Arjuna. He's saying, just kill Bhishmadev. He has an old, worn-out garment. Just kill him, and he'll get a new one. That if you've seen some old cloth in the street, no one laments if you kick it away and give someone else a nice new dress. So just kill him, and everything will be all right. And now, Krishna is going to explain, because they're on a battlefield, and this time they had so many different types of weapons. They had a wind weapon, they had a rain weapon, earth weapon, fire weapons, air weapons, and Arjuna has to fight. So the question is, what happens to the soul if he gets hit by Brahmastra? One thing if he just gets stabbed, but what happens if he gets hit by the ultimate weapon? The Vishnu Dwara or something, or Shiva Dwara. So what will happen? Will he get burnt or dried out, or is there anything you can do? So Krishna in the next three verses explains that nothing happens to the soul. It doesn't matter whether he's burnt or dried or moistened or whatever. Text 23. Nainam chinanti shastrani nainam dahati pavaka nachainam kledyatyapo nashoshiti marata. The soul can never be cut to pieces by any weapon, nor burned by fire, nor moistened by water, nor withered by the wind. Text 24. Achedo yamadayo yam akledyo shosheva cha nitya sarvagata stanora achaya yam sanatanam. This individual soul is unbreakable and insoluble. It can neither be burnt nor dried. He is everlasting, present everywhere, unchangeable, immovable, and eternally the same. Many different qualities are explained here, just like the soul is present everywhere. Prabhupada used this argument to explain how the soul is present even on the sun planet, according to Krishna's statement here, that there are living entities who have fiery bodies and they live on the sun planet, and for them it's quite normal temperature. You know, they say there's when on the sun planet it can be a million degrees centigrade, but for them it's quite comfortable. There's no air conditioning on the sun planet. And indeed, as there was one article in Back to Godhead some time ago, the scientists, although they claimed that it was not possible to live in such temperature underneath the water, in fire. But then they did some experiments. They went underneath the water and they found that there's cracks in the earth at very low depths. And in those cracks, fire is coming out up to 600 degrees centigrade. And there are living entities living in the fire that's coming out. But as soon as the temperature went down 100 degrees or so, then all the living entities would die from the cold. That destroyed their idea that sterilization, they say if you get a certain amount of degrees and everything dies. But in this case, they could only live at a certain degree temperature. And then when it went below that temperature, they couldn't survive. It's the Dr. Frog and the Whale philosophy that we don't experience it, if we don't know about it, it can't exist. But in this case, when the scientists find out something that they didn't know about, that they hadn't experienced before, then they simply include it. They say, well, only up until this degree can living entities live. Now it's 600 degrees. But Vedic literature is not so narrow-minded. If we accept the authority of the Vedas, then we have to understand that living entities can live in the fire. They live in the cold, they live everywhere. We may not be able to live underneath the water, but that doesn't mean that there are no living entities underneath the water. Similarly, we may not be able to live in fire, but that doesn't mean that there are no living entities in fire. Because the soul is completely transcendental. It's not affected by any of these material elements, therefore it can live anywhere, under any circumstances, if it gets a suitable body provided by the material nature. Yes. It can mean a number of things. For instance, we can say that the soul never moves because he's not part of the material world. He's never moving because he's not doing anything. The other thing is he's not moving from his transcendental position, a servant of Krishna. Although he's thinking that he's something other than Krishna's servant now, but he never really moves from that position. He's only imagining that he's doing something. Yeah. Yeah. He can't move the soul. Of course the soul does, he seems to move when he transmigrates. But he's not really moving from his transcendental position. But who does the transmigration? It's the super soul. He moves him from one body to the next. Seems like that. That's the illusion, being in a material body. Just like if you're watching a movie, it seems that you're actually, sometimes it may even seem, you get so absorbed in the movie, you actually kind of start feeling that, you know, I'm really part of the movie. I'm like, I'm the hero now. You know, now I've just jumped over the bridge and, you know, the machine guns are firing and I've missed, you know, I'm just dodging them and the bomb hit, but I, you know, I'm still alive and I just keep on running. So you become so absorbed in the movie, you think that you're part of the movie. So similarly, we're so absorbed in this material concept of life, we're actually thinking that we're actually doing everything. But we're just observing the whole thing. It's just due to false ego that we identify ourselves with it. But for a enlightened soul, he sees, I have nothing to do with this material body or this material world. I'm completely aloof. It's just a, what do they call it? What's a low type of movie? Three grade, what do they call the low movies? Grade B movie. Or an X-rated movie, whatever. Yeah. Yeah, in the spiritual world, but then we have to learn how to move. It says everyone is dancing with Krishna, but those who are dancing with Krishna's Maya, they're dancing with illusion. Trying to imitate Krishna, they're simply dancing with Krishna's Maya. But those who are dancing in harmony with Krishna, they're dancing Krishna's Rasa dance. So we have movement, we have the capacity to desire here, so that's a symptom of the activity of the soul. So in the spiritual world, we have one activity, which is to love Krishna. And that manifests itself in different varieties of activities. So here, everything is enacted and created by Krishna out of because of our lust. And there, everything goes on simply due to our love, or prema, how we're engaged. Yes. Maybe. He didn't want to lose his 10,000 followers. Spent a long time trying to get his body. Besides that, it's a little hot. It may not be your body, but if you get burnt, you feel it, because you have consciousness. Besides that, he was a little bit in Maya. After offending King Ambarish, kind of lost some of his good qualities. Yeah. He may feel it, but not in the same way we do. Just like if you're in your car and someone knocks in your car, you can hear it. If they shake your car, you can feel it. But you don't become overwhelmed, you know, if you're not so attached to your car, especially if it's someone else's car. Then you're aware of it, but you're not so affected by it. You don't lose it. You don't lose it. Jump out of the car and say, "You hit me," you know. Or you hit my friend's car. Yeah. Let me. If what? Well, he's the soul. The mystic yogi is the soul.
I heard that he travels on his consciousness. Or really, the soul leaves the body and has somehow a connection still with the body because he must come back to the body.
Oh, I don't know about that. I'm not. If I did, it would only be someone's opinion. I mean, I know different opinions. I have no personal experience like that. But Prabhupada said that at night you leave the body in your subtle body. So Prabhupada would say that a number of times, you actually leave your body. But there's different opinions about that. Yeah, like in dreams. There's also different opinions according to the Vedanta Sutra and according to all these New Age philosophers. You know, some of them say you're connected with a golden thread. And anyhow, eventually when you really leave your body, you're really going to leave it. That's what really counts. But if you're not, you leave it and you're connected to it by some way, subtle way or not. It's not really so important. And I can't really tell you. I'm not on that platform. Look at that golden thread, you know. There he goes. Follow that thread. Yes. Yeah.
You were saying in the beginning of the lecture that when you're not connected to the guru, the Christian, then you can chant for some time. So if someone chants for a long time,
yeah, if you're chanting 24 hours a day, you're quite advanced. Especially if you chant out of love. You can chant 24 hours a day, you can train up a parrot. And 24 hours a day you can chant, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. But the test will be if you grab the parrot by the throat and then go, So we shouldn't chant like a parrot 24 hours a day. But still, it's nice, even if we can chant 24 hours a day. But there's a story of Ram Dass. He was chanting 24 hours a day, Ram, Ram, Ram. And he was journeying to Jagannath Puri with Raghunath Bhat. When he came to Jagannath Puri, he met Raghunath Bhat Goswami. He met Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who was very pleased to see him because he was a great devotee. But then, when he saw Ram Dass, although Raghunath Bhat Goswami was thinking he must be a great devotee, he's always chanting Hare Krishna and serving the Vaishnavas. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't pay him any attention because he knew that Ram Dass, within himself, he was thinking that he was Ram. That's why he was always chanting his name. His name. He thought that was his name. Everyone likes to hear their name, so he was chanting he was a little bit more fanatical about it, that's all. Therefore, chanting also has to have some quality. We can admire someone who can chant 24 hours a day, but if one can even chant a little bit with some devotion, it's more valuable. Yes?
It seems that persons who are not aware of the devotion factor, who develop some kind of mystical understanding, that they can achieve a pure degree of realizing that I'm like a body thing, but they still remain confused. They still want to enjoy something. Some kind of spiritual
stuff. Yeah, of course. That's what happens, is you want to enjoy. It's subtly gross, but still it's material enjoyment.
People become very impressed
by it. Yeah, well, we just have to train ourselves so that we're not so impressed by it. If it's in democracy, what's real and what's not real is according to what people are impressed by. But that's not what ultimately reality is. Whether people are impressed or not.
But the people think that this is devotion, that this person really has devotion for God. And
yeah,
they have to convince them that person isn't actually
a devotee. Yeah. Prabhupada said if a person is awake, asleep, it's very easy to wake them up. But if a person is awake, but they're pretending to be asleep, then it's very difficult to wake them up. So people who don't want to know about Krishna, but at the same time want to think that they're spiritual, then it's very difficult to convince them about Krishna. That's the last person they want to be convinced about.
How is it that people become emotionally involved with this impersonal understanding?
Because they like it.
But it's an emotional person to be involved.
Hardly anyone. Even just like if you go to India where most people are impersonalists, as soon as you act impersonally towards them, they become very disturbed. So although they have an impersonal philosophy, their philosophy is that everyone is God, but especially their God. That's all. This is saying everyone has, in the material world, practically speaking, everyone has the same philosophy. that everyone is thinking that they're supreme. They like, in personalism nowadays, generally means materialism. The impersonal, such as Prakashananda Saraswati, in order to realize Brahman, they go through great austerities. They gave up all sense gratification. They'd simply study Vedanta and try and understand it and meditate. But the so-called impersonalists nowadays, they're out playing tennis and football and taking drugs and intoxication. And when you tell them about some philosophy, you say, well, it's all right. This, my tennis game will lead me to the Supreme. So what can you tell them? Because they're not really that. Some people are not genuinely, they're sincerely not sincere. They've really made an occupation to do everything necessary to be sincere about being insincere. What about them? Yeah, that's what Krishna says. Klesho dikataraste sham avyakta sakta chetasam avyakta higatira dukam dehavapira vapyate. So, to make advancement on that path is very difficult for those who are embodied. And it's simply full of klesha. It's full of misery. Just like Jai Dwaita Maharaj was saying today, when a cow gets burnt, if he's in a barn, and then a fire starts, and he gets burnt, and he runs out of the barn. So every time he sees red, he thinks of the fire. Some people, they want to get out of the material world because it's unpleasant. But the only thing they know is that all the unpleasantness of the material world is due to the variety and the personalities that are within the material world. So negate all these things, and then I can go to some place where no one's going to disturb me. And there I can just think I'm God. Here I'm thinking I'm God, and so many people disturbing me because they don't agree, they don't know the truth. Because they're envious, although I say in Bhagavad Gita that the fools arrive at my descending in this human form. They don't know my spiritual nature, my supreme dominion over all the pit. So rather than fight it out here with all these envious people who can't recognize that I'm God, I'll go to my original home where at least I can sit and think I'm God all day long, or eternally, no one's going to bother me. There's only one person there and he agrees with me. So it's a nice, for those who want to be God, it's a nice path. Yeah, to themselves. They're devotees of themselves. Even as Jai Dwaita Swami points out, and I've met other people like that, that they want to serve Krishna because they think ultimately they become Krishna. So whatever service I give to Krishna is just like putting in my bank account. And eventually when I realize I'm Krishna, then I just collect it all, that's all. It's like you have $1 million in one hand and for charity you give it to your other one. You think I'm quite generous. What time is we have? Anything else? Yes. Yeah, we still have a little tinge of impersonalism. It's not so easy to overcome this impersonalism and materialism. Therefore, we say that Prabhupada came nirvishesha shunyavadi to dispel impersonalism and materialism. These are the two diseases that we're covered by. They manifest, as Prabhupada says in Bhagavad Gita, as Vita Raga Baya, Raga Baya and Krodha. So due to our impersonalist tendency, we're fearful of our spiritual identity. And because we're fearful of our spiritual identity, we are, that's impersonalism. We don't want to worship Krishna as a person. Because if he's a person, then he's one up on us. If we're all impersonal, ultimately, then the only person we'll be left around here is Krishna. And if I'm not Krishna, then he's greater than I am. And if he's greater than I am, he's going to spend eternity lording it over me. And that's what I've been trying to avoid. I've been trying to become God myself and trying to control everyone, but it seems that everyone has the upper hand on me eventually. Therefore, we don't want to, we're fearful of spiritual, our spiritual identity. So that's impersonalism. Unless we find out how nice Krishna is, that he's not exactly as I conceive him, that he's a personality, transcendental personality, who doesn't have material motivations and material aspirations as an ordinary conditioned soul has. He's an all-generous, all-benevolent personality. Then it's very hard to be accept the idea that it's nice to become a person. So without knowing Krishna, we're all impersonalists. To some degree. Yes. In the society of, what is it? In the kingdom of fools, it's folly to be wise. That's the Bhagavatam says. Swavit vrahostra karar samstuta purusha parshu niyat karma patiyo peto jatinamaga dagarja. That hogs, dogs, camels, and asses, they're praised by the little hogs, dogs, camels, and asses. That if you can be like a lion, a tiger, then all the little jackals and all the other, they're all paying obeisances, offering pranams and prayers to the big animal. So similarly, someone may come along and claim he's God and he can manufacture some dust or ashes, and people offer him all kinds of respect. But one who's in knowledge, he's not so bewildered, that's all. Just like Prabhupada's that story he tells, or at least the story of the yogi who meditated for so long to get the mystic power of walking on water. So finally he walked across the water, and all the townspeople, the village people on the other side, they all fell down the ground offering him obeisances and respects and praise, except for one little boy. He didn't do anything. So the yogi walked over to him and said, "What? You're in Maya. Why don't you offer me some praise and respect?" He said, "Why should I?" So the yogi said, "What do you mean, why should you? I just walked across water." So the little boy said, "For, 25 paise, I could do the same thing. I can just get a boat." So this idea that praising someone just because they have some higher material quality, but if they're not a devotee of Krishna, then they also have to experience repetition, birth, and death. And anyone who follows them, they wind up in the same place. Just because one has some better degree or higher degree of control of the material world, that doesn't mean they're not a thief. Just to use strong language. Because everything here belongs to Krishna. Everything here belongs to Krishna. Therefore, unless we utilize things in Krishna's service, we're actually stealing from Krishna. Just like, for instance, if a group of thieves, they go to school and they learn electronically how to break into a bank. So they do it in the latest scientific gadgets. So they break into the bank and they get arrested. So they would be there before the court and the judge says, "You just stole." But they say, "Well, we didn't exactly steal. It wasn't an ordinary theft. We did it scientifically. So you should excuse us." So certainly in the material world, no matter how powerful a person may be, if he's not a devotee of Krishna, if he's not following Krishna's instructions, then he's a thief. And he'll be punished by the laws of nature. No matter how many people praise him and follow him, they'll all go to the same destination, that's all. So we'll stop there. Thank you very much. Just using Jai Dvaita Maharaj's technique he explained today. Grantara Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Continuing on with chapter 2. The verses from 1 to 10, they describe more about Arjuna's reluctancy to fight. And from verses 11 to 30, describe about Jnana Yoga, the difference between the body and the self. And then, the next part, which we should come to, from verses 31 to 38, they describe about Karma Kanda. And then from 39 to 47, it describes about Buddha Yoga. Anyhow, we have to go through that. There's the middle part of the second chapter has a lot of different twists and turns. But here in chapter 2, we were reading from all the different types of weapons. So we'll just go through that again. Actually, we went through that. So now we're on verse number 26. So here, Krishna is saying that, Arjuna, if you think that you're your body, then you should fight. Because after all, the body, if you think you're your body, the body is just a group of chemicals, a combination of chemicals. And no one laments if a group of chemicals are dissolved or if they're splattered or whatever. They're just a group of chemicals. So if the body is just made out of the different elements, and if the body dies, then what is there to lament about? In the past, it was just a group of chemicals, and it was arranged in a certain way. Now it's simply a group of chemicals, and it's arranged in a different way. And in the future, it'll simply be a group of chemicals, and it'll simply be arranged in a different way again. So why should you lament over how the chemicals are arranged? On the other hand, if you think you're your body, if you believe in the body, then it doesn't matter what happens to the body because nothing's going to happen to you. So either way, if you identify yourself with the body, then the body's just a group of chemicals. And if you think you're not your body, then why do you care what happens to the body? So this text 26. Atta chayanam nitya jatam nityam vamanam.